Everyone struggles with self-doubt and motivation in their careers, especially us artists. That's why we started the Other 22 Hours podcast. I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hase. I'm a music producer and writer, and I've spent years on the road with tons of different bands.
And I'm Michaela Ann, a singer-songwriter who's put out half a dozen records both independently and with labels and toured all over the world. So we've lived these challenges and conversations ourselves.
Each episode is an artist-to-artist conversation with different musicians, be it Grammy winners like Mary Chapin Carpenter or the Milk Carton Kids, bands like Lucius or Maddie Diaz, songwriters like Lori McKenna, or even legacy artists like Rodney Crowell and Alice Gerard. Each one of them share the tools and routines they've found to stay sane, creative, and inspired while their livelihood is based on their art.
So whether you're an artist yourself or anyone with a passion for creative endeavors, these chats will leave you feeling more inspired, connected, and confident in your own creative journey.
The Other 22 Hours is available wherever you're listening to this podcast, and it's on YouTube. So go find your favorite episode today.
Hello and welcome. This is Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. Hello, I am the host of this podcast, Cindy Howes. Thank you for finding us. Today on the pod, we have folk hero David Wilcox. Get to that momentarily. But first, have you signed up for Basic Folk's newsletter? If you listen to this podcast a lot, you know that I ask this question every time. And if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, oh man, it's so easy to do so at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com, sign up there, and get on our email list, and we'll let you know what is happening on the pod. You can also follow us on social media. We are at Basic Folk on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. We're a listener-supported podcast. Therefore, you can make a donation at basicfolk.com, or there is a link in the show notes to do so. How are you doing? Oh my gosh. I am feeling the fall, loving it, excited about it, getting my cozy candles ready to go, taking out my sweaters, maybe thinking about resoling those boots that I've had for like 10 years that just basically have no traction on the bottom. That would be a good thing to do. Really enjoying it. Okay, let's get into the pod. David Wilcox. Asheville-based songwriter David Wilcox has been through some SHIT. A difficult childhood in Northeast Ohio sent him seeking answers, mostly on his bicycle, in an attempt to get away. He has spent his lifetime leaning into his problems and digging into their root at the source, his own heart. He decided to see what lessons his heart had been trying to teach him, and at 67 years old, he's still listening and learning. He claims to have the answer of how to heal your heart and how to do it in 2 minutes. He lays it out in our conversation. We also talk about his new album, The Way I Tell the Story, which continues his exploratory journey through the lens of his wife's Parkinson's diagnosis, retelling the story of his childhood, staying calm in an emergency, and the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, which has devastated his community. We discuss how David has learned the ability to walk the line of acknowledging his talents without getting too caught up in the hot and fast success he experienced at the start of his career. He explains when it's best to feel the depths of sorrow versus disassociate. He talks about his lifelong love of cycling and how it continues to be a meditation and a lifesaver. David is full of gems and wisdom, and I think I'll be listening back to this one many times over. We'll take a listen to a clip from the new record. This is the title track, The Way I Tell the Story, and then we'll get to our conversation with David Wilcox on Basic Folk.
I was the lone survivor when we landed in the field. Full investigation never was revealed. The hurt got covered over, never really healed. The scars are on the inside, the evidence was sealed. But the way I tell the story, I just brushed off the dirt. staff barely tore my shirt. What good would it do me to just replay the past? Accidents will happen. This one happened fast.
David Wilcox, welcome to Basic Folk. It's such an honor to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Congrats on the new album, The Way I Tell the Story. I want to say that you come across as a pretty positive person. Where do you think that comes from? Like, do you feel like a positive person? What's your relationship to positivity in yourself and in others?
I think the answer that might serve best would be, I'm not a positive person by what I see, but I have learned that my hopelessness does nobody any good. And so I trust this process of emotional alchemy, which I think is synonymous with songwriting, that can take the sorrows and the tragedies and the injustices and kind of take them apart and find a way to live a life of dignity, no matter what, no matter what the situation is, and make decisions that feel like a good story, that feel like a life worth living. And it's not depending on the world changing to my liking. It's just depending on not being just a puppet to my own initial reactions, like fear and anger and judgment and all that. And so that sounds like a spiritual practice, but really you could just say that for me, having a steady discipline of coming to this studio, this quiet room, and pretending I'm writing a song. And yes, there are songs, but songs are not what I'm after. Coming to the studio as if my real goal is just saying to my heart, so what's up? What do we need to talk about? And through the subtle discernment of writing a song, I gather a perspective which is not my own. I gather a perspective which is more evolved than where I am. It's more about where I'm going to be, but I get a glimpse of it through the song. And then I get to sing the song and hold myself accountable to that perspective. So positive, I'm positive that I can live a life of dignity in this world. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's a great adventure.
How do you get to that point where, I mean, it sounds like you're sitting down and you're like, here's where I am, but you are wanting to like pull yourself forward. Are you saying that like the act of like writing the song is pulling you forward and evolving you?
Yes, and it is not the song itself, but the lifetime practice of the discernment that I learn through the process of writing, so that I not only can gather a song, which is thousands and thousands of choices that are all made by heart, I can not only gather a song together, but in the process of doing that, I can trust how I know which line is better, or which riff is better, or which rhythm is better. And those are emotional questions. That's coming to my heart and saying, which one feels right for this? Which one expresses the way my heart is trying to get me to feel? And through that subtle discernment, I then have the ability to navigate life with a more intact GPS, internal GPS, not just my strategy and cleverness, but also all the clues that I'm getting from my subtle intuition that I have learned to trust, even though it's tiny little inputs, I can navigate including that in my decision making, so that what I'm after is not songs, but a life that sings, a life that feels like as good as a good song.
Beautiful. From what I gather, you're also a very silly person. Like, you're easy to laugh. You get pretty excited and laugh in interviews. But you're also like a revered songwriter who has written about serious topics, and you can be a serious person. Can you talk about like what it's like to have your serious side and your silly side kind of like live in parallel?
I'm hearing this lovely song by the Bobs called Mr. Dichotomy. It's really great. It's the best answer to that question. But if I had to answer without hearing the Bobs sing Mr. Dichotomy, I would say...
For those who haven't heard it.
I would say that it is a joy that comes naturally when I'm not a puppet to my initial fears. And so I can be seriously writing about all that's broken and needs to be fixed. And at the same time, I'm not sunk by it. Like, you know, there's this one song on this new record, which is about the way a tiny little boat holds back the whole ocean. And if you can not sink in the sea of sorrow, you can be useful. You can, you know, like stay afloat and be part of the solution instead of just being killed by the depression. And so I do this not because it's easy for me. I do this because I need to. My family of origin stuff, just a wreck, just a mess, just, you know, everybody's depressed, everybody's medicated, everybody's like hospitalized for depression. And my brother just died 2 weeks ago, and he was ridiculously unhappy all his life. And I looked at all that and I said, okay, so this is my genetic sort of destination, but I'm going to grab the wheel. I'm not going to go off the cliff. And so I decided that I was going to do some cardio spelunking on purpose. I wasn't going to put it off. I wasn't going to isolate and just, you know, pretend everything's fine.
Cardio spelunking.
Yeah.
Could you please define?
You know, going into the cave. You got a top rope and you got the world's best flashlight, which is music. And you go into the scary place as if, you know, there's going to be things that you've never seen before. There's going to be underground rivers. There's going to be, you know, prehistoric writing. There's going to be lessons that your heart's been trying to tell you for years. And I describe it that way because, you know, it's a taboo thing in our culture, for lots of contrived reasons, for people to be out of touch with their own navigation. And so we have made it taboo to have your whole GPS working, including your beautiful heart. And so, you know, this makes people buy more things, and it's you know, makes the gross national product more gross. But what it does is it keeps us from living a life that feels alive. And so I've decided, you know, why not just hack all that? Why not just break the taboo and decide that I have the authority to feel what I want to feel find the real juicy life, find the life that's deep and high and interesting. And so that's what I do.
This line from your bio inspired this question, where it says, staying soft in a hard world isn't a liability. It's a kind of leadership. Why does softness make a good quality in a leader? Like, where did you learn how to be soft, and how can we get back to softness?
Listening to each other as if it's not a zero-sum game, I think makes our conversations more interesting, and it also is really good for our hearts. I think it is verging on a sacred sort of practice to listen with the intent to understand. And so, you know, like I bumped into a neighbor. We started having this conversation. We both have motorcycles in common. We were getting to be friends. And then he kind of like stopped cold and he said, wait, I got to know your politics, because if we differ on politics, we really should not even try this. And I said, really? I said, why? He said, well, you know, it's just, I don't want to hear you, you know, get all riled up. And those kind of conversations, they always just reduce themselves to yelling. I said, yes, because it's entertaining. If people are watching and they're afraid to bring up their own opinion, so they want to watch someone else get angry. But I don't like that. I think it's much more fun to listen in and see if I can say someone else's point of view better than they can. And he kind of opened his eyes like, well, that's weird. Don't you like want to fight for your team? Don't you want to like, you know, die on the battlefield of some ridiculous abstraction of an idea? I said, no, I'd just like to get to know you. You're my neighbor. And so we got to know each other and we differ and we understand better how we differ. And I love to like lean into like trying to describe his point of view. Is it like this? And I come up with a cool metaphor and he thinks about it and he's, yeah, but it's more like that. And I see, and then he's done it too, coming back with my point of view with some interesting little metaphor that makes it realize, oh, I can see it when you reduce it down to something simple. But, you know, it's, so I love the adventure of seeing the world through someone else's eyes. And I think that if the goal of politics is solutions, which obviously it isn't, but if it were, I think it would be much more efficient to have people who actually knew how to do that, how to communicate. You know, most people, if you're going to hire somebody for a job, find out if they can do the job, you know, like find out if a plumber has ever plumbed before, you know. And I think it'd be cool to have politicians actually have to like drop them in a volatile situation and see if they can get people talking to each other. That's their job. But we don't see it that way. Anyway, I'm ranting and that's probably not the depth of what you wanted. So go on.
I feel like you just laid out the blueprints for healing the nation, David.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's all completely taboo and people would freak the hell out. What? We have to feel?
And talk to each other.
And talk to each other.
I want to hear about your origin story when it comes to riding your bicycle. You grew up east of Cleveland in Mentor, Ohio, right on Lake Erie. And I heard that you were on your bicycle nearly all the time, adventuring as much as possible. And it still seems like you're riding from your new song, The Reason Why I Ride. But what were your surroundings like for your adventures growing up on your bicycle?
It was mostly just getting away, but I did have this powerful sense of the future has to be better. And I remember a couple situations in my early life where I was thinking death would be better. And then I thought, no, actually, if there's nothing to lose, like if death is like on the negotiating table, then why not just try everything else fearlessly? Because we've always got that to fall back on. And so it just seemed like escape, but also a feeling of there must be something better that I haven't seen around the corner. And especially bicycling, lots of different countries, seeing how culture is not, you know, it can be different. It's not carved in stone, so to speak. And so, yeah, bicycling has always been a beautiful meditation for me. And I was just cycling in Italy a couple months ago, and man, nice. There's just something about the the road that follows the river, and it's just so pretty.
Yeah. I have not spent a lot of time in Cleveland, but I did spend a lot of time in Pittsburgh, living and working in Pittsburgh, which is a very challenging biking town. But have you ever ridden around Pittsburgh?
Sure. I did the Gap Trail.
Nice.
You know what I mean?
Very good.
Great,
yes.
Great, yeah. Allegheny Passage. Yeah. And I have lovely friends in Pittsburgh that, but you know, these names, like you said, near Lake Erie, it's actually worse than that. North of me, yes, the lake was Erie, but west of me, the river was Chagrin. And east of me, it was actually literally Painesville.
Oh.
You see, I had to get away.
Right, right. So you started playing guitar when you were 18, writing mm-hmm. at age 20, and then I heard you talking about teaching guitar at like a music camp when you were around 22. And I loved what you said. You said you were a good teacher because you could isolate the variables, take a complex thing, divide it up into its parts, and make it teachable.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a very good and translatable skill for you, especially in terms of like breaking down complex emotional situations. Like, does that seem true? And how does that impact your approach to writing about complex issues?
It's the best thing music has taught me. Well, actually, I said something else was the best thing just 5 minutes ago. There's a lot of best things. But yes, figuring out how to take a complex thing apart and learn each part separately so that you still regain your confidence, so that it doesn't seem like a complex thing. It just seems like a lot of easily learnable, simple things that you have to do at the same time. So you learn one at a time. It becomes easy. And yes, I did learn that from music, but it's taught me how to learn everything. And I'm very grateful for that. There was another part to your question. I forget.
Well, the other part was, how does that impact your approach to writing about complex issues?
Ah, emotion. Yes. Wow. That's fascinating. I'm not sure I have any clarity on that. It seems like when I'm going for a song, I think what I'm trying to do is gather things that have the same sort of emotional signature and gather enough of them that they all kind of are in phase, so to speak, emotionally. They all it's as if, you know, if you needed to get angry about something, if you wanted to feel the most intense anger, you would fish around for the things that you are riled up by and sort of distill them all, make this really concentrated aggregate of anger. And then you could like amp up that emotion. Everyone has experienced that, you know, when you really want to rant. But then you could do the same thing if you needed to really grieve. If there was something in your life you needed to grieve, you could say, okay, I've got time. Why don't we go there? Why don't we feel the depth of that sorrow? And then you just find different elements, different, could be musical, could be lyrical, different phrases that have that same emotional signature, that weight of emotion. And you gather enough of them together, in other words, write a song, and then suddenly your heart can feel the thing you wanted to feel. But it's as if instead of just hide, you know, dodging around the periphery of it, you go right into the center of it, and the weirdest thing happens. Instead of it being a hole that you fall into, the center of that emotion suddenly opens and turns into compassion and clarity and energy, vision. It's weird because it's such an easy trade, as if our hearts are made to do it. And it's not hard to do, but nobody does because we just haven't learned it. And it seems like that's the hack. That's the real sort of magical thing that changes everything when you realize, yeah, our hearts, they heal so easily. I mean, you know, you fall off your bike at speed and, you know, it'll take a while for the gravel rash to heal. It'll take a week and a half or more. But you can heal a heart in 2 minutes. You just go to the center of it and it changes. It's weird. And so I have loved that about songwriting. And so when I think about taking it apart, it's more, for me, my perception of it, it's no, with songwriting, with emotion, it's getting to the center of it. 'Cause there's, you know, like you start out, there's a frustration and you think, oh, this is an angry song, and you write it deeper and then you realize, no, it's a sad song. And then you go deeper and you think, no, at the center of this song, there's an apology that I need to make. Oof. And, you know, you get to that and suddenly the song is like open and there's possibilities, there's changes. But if you hadn't done that, you'd have just stayed with the anger forever.
How old do you have to be to get to the depths of sorrow?
I don't know, maybe 5 or 6. I remember grieving mortality at about 6 years old. I guess I was, for some reason, I didn't get that taboo. I think it was because of my dad. He had a bravery about that that was way ahead of his time.
So let's put a pin on the depths of sorrow. I want to go back to that. But first,
By the way, thank you. You're really good at this.
Oh, thanks. Oh, I'm enjoying this a lot.
Good.
The new album's title track, The Way I Tell the Story, is about getting creative with how you think about the events in your past so that you aren't just living out a victim story, and comes from childhood memories of home life crashing down and appreciating the handy skills of disassociation, which is just what you needed to get you through. So, like, in thinking about that, how do you try to remember the events of your childhood, and what was it like for you to get to that journey of your form of events?
What was it like to get to that, my version of events? The simple answer is, what was it like? It was like trading shit for gold. It was like, it was a freedom and a happiness. It was a way of having this easy emotional alchemy that changed old pain into wonder. And the playfulness in that song is, you know, instead of talking about childhood events, the song is just talking about a small plane crash, and, you know, you walk out of the wreckage and you're okay. And then you realize, well, since you're the only one who made it out, you know, you can, when they come running up and say, what happened? You have a lot of leeway with your story. You can make up a great one. So that's a playful way. That's a way of seeing a thing that happens inside, where something, there's some regret, there's some ache that I have in my heart. Oh, I messed that up. Why did I do it that way? Kind of thing. And I go to it and I say, do you want to just stay there for the rest of your life? Or are you feeling this because it's leading you somewhere? That's the outrageous assumption. The assumption that pain is not just punishment. It's like, follow the trail. This leads to freedom. Now, how would you, it's a counterintuitive assumption. Following the pain into the depth of the heart leads to freedom. Wouldn't it seem like, oh no, you're going to, you know, get sucked into the vortex and stay there forever? No, you stay there forever if you don't go in. So going into it playfully, the cardio spelunking image, it gives me this sense of like, oh yeah, well, just go right to the heart of it. It'll change. It won't hurt you. And the fascinating thing is, the thing that we're scared of is old pain. Now, it didn't kill us the first time, and now it's been years. It's not going to kill us now. So just go right in. And my experience of it is, it's just a great adventure. So, you know, so the way that I come to the new version of what I want to feel is more like when you come back from a camping trip and it was difficult, you know, there was some scrambling, there was some rock slides, there was, you know, there was some rain, the tent blew down, and you come back and people say, how was your adventure? And you say, oh man, it was great. And they say, what was your favorite part? And you say, well, I was standing in a thunderstorm in my underwear, holding a flashlight, trying to set the tent back up. And they say, that was your favorite part? And you say, well, it worked. I set the tent back up, and everyone else in the tent was really happy. And I came back inside and slept well. And they say, you know, well, the fact that you can call that the best part means that, you know, what is it that you're after when you go on an adventure? And so the way I tell the story is like, yeah, I came from a family that could have killed me. It actually killed my brother, and it didn't kill me. Why? Because I wasn't scared of feeling. Okay, that's too easy an answer. And everyone scoffs and says, oh, so you're just going to feel it now, huh? And that's part of the taboo. That's part of the ridiculous shaming of people who want to be able to overcome their old pain. But if people knew how easy it was and how natural it is for a heart to heal, they would realize, you know, it's on the verge of criminal the way we have been taught to not do that. But, you know, it keeps people buying things. So there are people who want to keep us ignorant of our own hearts.
So coming back to feeling the depths of sorrow,
yes,
versus disassociating, like, yes, do you still feel like there? I mean, you have laid out all the merits of feeling the depths of sorrow,
yes,
perfectly. But do you still feel like there's value in having the ability to disassociate?
Oh, of course. Like, you know.
And how do you know when to do what? Disassociate, okay, versus feel?
Well, for example, in emergency situations, I'm the guy you want around, because I'm not going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I'm just going, walking slowly to where the fire extinguisher is and thinking, okay, pin, left hand, right hand, handle, spray at the bottom. I'm speaking in soft tones. I'm doing the right thing. And it's great to know that I'll have plenty of time to feel, you know. And so, yeah, do what needs to be done. Keep everybody safe.
For survival.
Yeah. And so there are times, you know, when I hear some tragic news and I'm driving down the freeway, you know, okay, I gotcha. My brother is dead. I understand. I can be there in a week, but I can't be there right now. And so there are times to feel, and it's kind of a luxury. It's like, I mean, that's why we sit down to watch a movie. We want to feel something. But there's lots of movies in our own memories and in our own hearts that can give us a really cool perspective of our own story.
I feel like I could talk about this for a long time.
But... me too.
All right, let's keep going. So, okay, David, you were the talk of the town in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And from what we know, you did not handle your success well. You found that being famous is a lot of work and is a job on its own. Then you go on to say that you have to be careful because you could start to believe that I'm somehow special. So there has to be a balance here. Like, how do you work to not allow yourself to be swept away with your talents and successes while still maintaining your confidence in your talents?
That is such a beautifully crafted question. Good for you. God,
thanks.
That really says it well. Okay, so on the micro level, let's talk about, imagine that you have this amazing ability to stand in front of a crowd and they came to hear you and you're able to play a song that's going to make everyone in the room feel the same thing at the same time. That's a beautiful energy. And you ride that wave. I mean, it's like a big wave and it makes you feel so good that then there's this interesting problem that happens. And it happens when you walk off stage after the encore. And what happens is you have this thing circulating in your bloodstream like a drug, and it is an artificial self-image created by the energy of that crowd. And in our culture, we don't really have language for that. We don't even like believe it really exists, but the people who have felt it know that it's powerful. And the rock stars who die, die because of this, because of the letdown. Because when you have that bliss running through your veins and then it goes away, and it goes away fast, you have this weird free fall. So the first choice is when you're in that moment playing for the audience, you have a choice of how much you let that go through you. You know, you don't put your hand on the positive and your other hand on the negative and let it go through your heart. You don't juice yourself with that energy. You don't take it in as if you're hungry for it. You realize, yeah, that's a lot of energy. Whose energy is it? It's their energy. It's not mine. You hold up the mirror, you focus it, you give it back, but you don't let it buzz you. You don't let it make you high. And that's a discipline. And that's learned from the letdown, which can be so toxic. There's this song of mine called Infinity Pool, which is about how to come down safely from that bliss. And it's about walking home from a gig, not taking the ride, not taking the town car to the hotel, but walking down the sidewalk at night and looking up and looking around and remembering there's all this life bigger than me. And then the image that I use to describe the emotional process in the song is the swimming pool that's at the very top of the hotel. By the way, it is a metaphor. There wasn't that pool, but the experience feels like you go to the top of the skyscraper and there's a pool that has this pour over edge. So it's as if the veil is thin between the mystical bliss that has sustained you and the rest of the city. It's like it's all the same thing. So you can let that bliss pour back into the city and you don't feel hungry for it. And so this Infinity Pool, this one of my favorite songs, another song that really saved my life, it taught me how. You have this ability to let it go, to kind of cleanse your system from that bliss, which is a brave thing to do, because isn't it the bliss that you want? Isn't it the bliss that you did this all for? Yes and no. You want the sustainable bliss. You don't want the deadly bliss. And so the beautiful process of letting that go, that was really good. So there was a two-part thing to your question. One part was, how do you not get killed by the bliss? And the second part was, well, you need some of the bliss in order to have the audacity to pretend that what you're doing matters. And I love that word audacity. And that's the word that's so... it says that in order to work this hard at this craft, you have to believe that people are going to hear it and feel it and it's going to matter. And that is an unsubstantiated assumption. It's something that you just believe because you want to, and it sort of works in your life. And so you can believe it enough when you need it and you can let it go enough. It's sort of like that old... there's a beautiful teaching, a spiritual teaching about two notes. You carry one in the right pocket, you carry one in the left pocket. This is old language, but read into it. And one of them, when you need it, when you're tipped to one side, you open this note and it says, you are made in the image of God, and you put it back in your pocket and you kind of come back to center. But if you get too far the other way, you take out the other note and it says, you are dust. And you go, oh yeah, that's true too. And you have one in each pocket and they're the perfect ballast. And you use them as you need them. And this can happen like real time, like in the middle of a gig or in the middle of a conversation. You can be real proud of this idea you want to say. And then you come back to, I'm sorry, I'm performative right now. I need to get real with you. And it changes your voice. It changes your pace. And you come back to, I really want to talk to you. I'm not just shouting to the, you know, to the crowd.
Have you, okay, so we just watched this movie the other night. It was kind of like a horror movie, actually. So I don't know if you like, it was a little gnarly. It's called Opus with John Malkovich.
Haven't seen it.
There are some interesting themes of what fame and like making people feel special and making people feel like they have too much bliss going on can do to a person.
Yeah.
It's particularly gory at one part of the film. So I don't know if you're into those or not, but John Malkovich is always doing really interesting things, but you might enjoy this movie.
Yeah.
Minus the gore.
No worries. Tell me more about it.
So it's about John Malkovich plays this pop star who hasn't released. He's like a reclusive pop star who hasn't released music in 30 years.
Yeah.
So he's going to release an album and he invites five people from the industry to his home for like a VIP listening experience, like a weekend at his home.
Yeah.
And it just like goes south pretty quickly. There's a lot of like cult-like themes to it. But there's one, the star of the film, she's a young actor who is also in The Bear. She's like one of the main characters in The Bear. So she's a journalist, but she hasn't gotten to write anything for this magazine yet. And it's like, it's kind of like, she's like, I think she's in her 20s and I can see myself in her where she's like, you know, I'm special and I want to do something incredibly important, but she's not very interesting. So it kind of like follows her storyline and it actually turns out that John Malkovich's character has some like real murderous evil intentions of like inviting these five particular people to his compound for the weekend. But yeah, it definitely was gross, but it like sparked a lot of conversations about like what fame can do to people and when people think that they should be VIP and invited to this like really special exclusive thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's called Opus. Yeah, I think we watched it on HBO. It was on an HBO movie, but okay. Now this is asking more of like a music business side of your brain, or maybe not. So you have released music independently. You've released on a major label. You've also signed with some indie labels. And when I see the list of different labels that you've been on and think about like all of the deals you must have looked over and negotiated and agreed to, I wonder how that experience impacted the type of negotiator you are and how you feel about the value of your music.
Interesting question. Learning about negotiating and what it gave me in terms of the value of my music. Wow. Again, the two notes, the value of my music is nothing because music is free. And negotiating, I have learned a lot about, but it's more about finding a way to think and speak of the goals that we have in common with the person that I'm negotiating with. By the way, if I wasn't a musician, I'd probably be conflict resolution. I love those kinds of conversations. And I love to give those kind of conversations time and do them in installments and come back with different ideas. And, it's fascinating. Thinking about record deals of the past, I did get to slide down the last little slope of the music industry before it, you know, emptied out onto the freeway. It was a fun ride, and I had the experience of seeing the incredible waste of the labels, you know, when they had all that money because people were buying their favorite CDs that they already had on vinyl. And so there was big catalog sales, and the labels were just trying to give away money to keep from paying taxes. So they would sign people like me. And so it was a fun ride. And yet it was definitely not reality based. I think I had really good mentors. I had people saying to me in the midst of that heady time, you know, this is a blue collar job. And that was really good advice. And there were people who would say, you know, after I did my strategic career sabotage on purpose to make sure that I didn't overload myself with stuff I couldn't handle, I would have people reassure me that there is a sweet spot with being sort of successful enough that you can believe that what you do matters, successful enough that you can afford to work at what you love, and successful enough that you get enough juice to sustain you emotionally, but not overdoing it, not crossing the line where you lose your anonymity and, you know, you lose your sense of security in your house and all that because people are snooping. I've had musicians who have really told me, you know, that Dave, you got it right. You found the sweet spot of, my favorite thing about being sort of what I call famous for folk, which I say with a definitely tongue in cheek because famous for folk means not at all famous, but that's good. I like it. It's, you know,
a minor folk celebrity.
A minor folk celebrity means that, you know, like maybe one person in the airport will say, "Hey, Wilcox," but that's it. And so, so my favorite thing is that I'm still hungry. I have never felt like I've made my best record. I always feel like, man, I learned a lot from that. And I still have that beautiful hunger about where is music taking me? I'm so curious. Each song is this like, wow, this is different. I wonder where this is going. And it would be so sad if I accidentally, you know, like broke open the pirate's chest and found the treasure, because, you know, then you're out of a quest, and the quest is the best part.
The custom songs that mm-hmm. you write, you have one on the record, actually, I Can't Argue, is a custom song.
Yeah.
So when you do these custom songs, you interview the person to find out about their situation. And you said that those custom songs are a good excuse to have a great conversation.
Yeah.
What are those interviews like? How do you approach them? How do you get people to open up?
They take about an hour. And I just, like if we were doing a custom song, I would say, So let's imagine the song is done. My question is, who's hearing it and what are they feeling? And if you know that this song is, say, for example, about saying something to somebody that you just can't find the words to say, and if you know what you want them to feel when they hear the song, then the questions can get really specific. Okay, so you want them to feel that, as opposed to what? Like, what might they feel, or what are they feeling now? And then you compare those two things and you say, so how do we get from this to that? What are the issues? What's the memories? What's the thing that happened? And it's just a matter of concentrating on the goal of the song. And that's another outrageous assumption I have. You know, Woody Guthrie said, you know, it can't just be a good song. It has to be good for something. And and I love that. I love thinking that a song moves you. Everyone knows that a song can move you. My question is, well, where's it moving you to? And is it moving you toward the person you want to be? I really think, you know, it's sort of like you are what you eat and you become what your heart envisions, and music transports us to emotional destinations that we have not been to yet. And yet, if we can picture it, we can get there. If we can really feel what it feels like, then we just are always sniffing for something that smells like that, because then we kind of follow it. And, you know, you want to know where the barbecue is, you just, oh, well, it's over there. And so if you want to know where a life that feels like home and feels like an adventure is, then you sing the songs that take you there. And whenever some little thing in your life shows up that sort of, ooh, that reminds me of that song, then you follow it and your life becomes that kind of adventure. And I just love that when we write the songs that really call in who we want to be and we send them out into the world, they are on a reconnaissance mission. They find not only the people that are our tribe and will understand us and really be our friends, they find the people, but they also find the coincidences. They find those miraculous events of timing with a capital T that take us to those places where life unfolds in surprising ways.
Is it okay to say how old you are?
Sure.
Okay.
I think I'm 67. I think I am. I was born in 58. Is that right?
I'd have to get my calculator. So you are of an age where you're asking yourself, what do I need to say to people in my life before it's too late?
Yeah. But I've always talked about that.
Of course.
Go ahead.
But now that you're this age,
right,
how do you approach conversations that encompass those feelings without alarm?
Without alarm, meaning I'm alarming the people who I'm talking to?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what songs are for. That's why, you know, you speak in parables. That's you give people the chance to unpack it so that it's their idea. You know, it's sort of like when you give a gift, you gift wrap it, and the person like takes it in their hand and they shake it, and one end's heavier than the other, and they kind of like think, oh, maybe what it, oh, and then they pull back the paper. Oh, it's, oh yeah, thank you. This is what I wanted. So they tell you what it is. They go, oh, look, it's a, and so when you do that with a song, then the song isn't just a sign, it's a symbol. And, you know, when you Google symbol, derivation, symbolon, broken piece of pottery, a way to trust a messenger, you put the two pieces of pottery together and you know this person actually came from your friend and you can trust the message. So when a song has a simple story that's irrefutable, that is set in parallel to a bigger idea that might create confrontation, the simple story seems to have a momentum that carries you into the same conclusion for the bigger story. And this is my favorite thing. A song has to surprise you. It can't just sort of trample up with the moral of the story. You know, that's like telling the punchline of the joke first. It just ruins everything. So yes, Signs, and there's a lot of songs that are just signs. Signs are like when you're going to a protest and you want to make a sign. It's got to be simple. It's got to be big. You make it fast. It's sloppy, but it says the thing. And you hold it up. And the people who agree with you go, yeah. And the people who don't. But what if you really wanted to change somebody's mind? You can't do that with a sign. A sign just divides people. If you wanted to change somebody's mind, you'd have to have a parable. You'd have to have a story that hides a secret message. You'd have to tell them a simple story that seems so obvious. They go, yeah. And then 2 days later, they're thinking about it and they go, fuck, I know what he was trying. Oh, that's so sneaky. And suddenly you find yourself understanding a point of view that you wouldn't have got to. And so that's what I love to do with songs. And that's the superpower of songs. Songs that don't do that are really missing an opportunity, in my opinion.
Hmm. Your wife, Nance, mm-hmm. was diagnosed with Parkinson's, which is something that you've mentioned in the conversations around this album.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, you've said her diagnosis has reframed everything, your perspective, process, and your writing. So specifically, could you get into how her diagnosis has reframed your perspective?
Well, first of all, it's been a long time coming. It's a dozen years. And so I've had time to stay current with my grieving. And at first, my grieving was so infantile. It was just like, uh-oh, my life is not going to be what I wanted. You know, and I was like fighting with reality. And then I realized, okay, this is a different adventure, but it's still an adventure. And it might be better. It might be better than just a bunch of passport stamps of exotic destinations. This might be actually a wilder territory. This might be a wilderness that will feel like I've actually gone somewhere and it's changed me. And so the ability to acclimate and enjoy adversity. And it has opened my sight to so many more people. You know, there was a time that I used to see a condition, you know, I would see someone who had a condition, but I would just see the condition and I wouldn't see, oh, that's a human being with a condition and they're a human being. So, you know, it's just the way kids sometimes stare at somebody who's missing a leg or something. And the, oh my, look at that. So at first I was like looking at what's missing. But then I was realizing, man, you can get around really well. And it's such a different way of seeing. And so there are emotional parallels, obviously, that have to do with, you know, mortality and the time that I've got left, we're all walking that way. So it has helped me really appreciate life.
All right, one more question and then we'll do a quick lightning round.
Okay.
Where does the impact of Hurricane Helene appear on the way I tell the story?
Great question. I wonder if I know. Let's see. Well, definitely my own mind, the storm of the century. there is some, there's some of that in the song Roses. Man, there's so many of these songs I really like. I'm looking at a list of what's on the record right now, and it's fascinating to me because, the song I Made It Rain is just talking about this thing that I do. I write and I play music. But describing it with this audacious, ridiculous comparison of like, oh yeah, I'm a rainmaker. I can do a thing that's impossible. And setting those two things side by side felt so interesting in that song, as if to say, yeah, it's simple and it's, you know, like almost meaningless. I make vibrations in the air that dissipate and are gone. It's, and yet the way I tell the story about it, it's sort of like, this absolutely saved my life. This turned a life that could have been tragic and suicidal into bliss and adventure. But how did the storm show up in these songs? Man, I think the storm is reflected in the song Endless Summer Blue, which is a song about, you know, I have loved deeply and somehow that stays. That's a, something that doesn't dissipate. Endless Summer Blue is a song about this fresh, new, beautiful, wondrous love as seen from the perspective of, you know, 40 years later, this diminishment and sorrow, and somehow the love is stronger and more durable and more somehow real. So the storm had that same effect of like, Asheville has been destroyed. No, no. The Asheville that I love was the neighbors coming together and who's got a chainsaw and who's got a generator. Asheville was more Asheville than ever in the middle of the hurricane in terms of like, what is the real emotion? What is the real heart of this town? And it's the people who come together and help each other. And so I think the song Beautiful, the beautiful is, you know, like that beautiful thing Mr. Rogers said about what do you do at 9/11? You look for the people who are helping. You look for the healers and the rescuers. And the song The Beautiful is what sustains us in the midst of these disasters that come through. And but I think the the best one for the storm is My Own Mind. I love that song.
Yeah. If listeners are listening and they have not heard, so that song addresses trying to stay peaceful while surrounded by alarm.
Yeah.
Which is a really good idea. Yeah. All right. Do you want to do a quick lightning round and then
I'll
let you go?
I'm happy to. Yeah.
Okay. What are you listening to on the bike ride?
I'm listening to the sound of tires coming up behind me and judging how fast they're going.
What is the most hilarious animal?
Oh, my. Great question. Hilarious. Wow. Yeah. It's the hilarious part that's really stumping me because I keep going to one image after another and then thinking, well, I don't know if that's hilarious, but, I'm not much of a lightning round person, apparently.
I keep okay.
answering
Nobody is.
The deeper question.
You should have heard Paul Brady's lightning round. It was not good.
Maybe the... Oh, I would love to interview Paul Brady. Wow, that must have been fun. I think maybe really I'm going to say the human being.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, David. The correct answer was cats. Thank you for playing. All right, two more. What is your favorite treat in Asheville, North Carolina?
Wow. And it's an edible treat, right?
Yes.
Hmm. Man, there's so many. There's the barbecue. It's great. There's the gelato. It's great. There's the chocolatier, you know, that there's all kinds of really great chocolate places. But the treat that I think I love the best is just getting up really early and getting on one of those ridgetop roads on my motorcycle and watching the sky start to get light. To me, that is kind of seeing the town in the distance all sleepy with a little layer of fog and the sun coming over the mountain. That's just the thing.
This one kind of relates. Where is the most beautiful place in the world?
And for this, I think it's not what you're looking at, but how you see. So the most beautiful place in the world. You know, there's that line in the old James Taylor song, home, build it behind your eyes. I like that a lot. I think it's the same with the most beautiful place in the world. I think it's how you see. And what song am I thinking? What Leonard Cohen song has that? She showed me Between the Garbage and the Flowers. Suzanne, right? Doesn't that have something about how we see? Yeah, I don't know. Anything else?
Well, that's it. No, that's the lightning round.
Okay, you're so good. Can I ask you some questions?
Sure.
What's your favorite part of interviewing people?
I think when you know it's going to go well and it's not going to be hard, like getting all the questions ready.
Wow. Meticulousness. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite part is preparing. That's really good.
Yeah.
Wow. I like that. Huh. Nice. I'm so tempted to sort of ask particular names about people you've interviewed.
Please.
Because I know that I have felt this weird wrestling with some people doing interviews where, you know, they where I feel like I'm being sort of as if sort of pulled around, like someone, I'm walking on the sidewalk with someone and they're like grabbing my shoulders and pulling me left and right. They want me to kind of say particular things. I can tell that they have an agenda about like what this is about. And,
right.
And there are times when I will do one of my ridiculous, like way too long answer, Dave, which just, she just asked you what your influences were. And, you know, and so I love that tussle. But I love doing it with kindness, I love the people who are kind of have a grudge. You can tell about the way I'm answering the questions, but eventually they kind of come around to, okay, so you apparently are not going to play by the rules, but you know it's.
Well, I have like a pretty high anxiety level. So I feel like when that kind of thing, it doesn't happen to me so much anymore because I don't do live radio interviews anymore. Uh-huh. But like that feeling would come across me and I would feel it so deeply, but I don't think anybody could tell.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Of like what was going on because I do a really good job of like masking the fear and the terror and the like, oh no.
Yeah, that's a fascinating skill. When you're really feeling stress, speak slower, as if you just like, now here's an interesting question. And then have an where you know what you're going to say, but you just go, that's such a fun skill. I love that.
Another thing I like to do is if someone isn't speaking into the microphone enough, I try to like lean in to be like, maybe they'll like do exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And one final question, the sailing ships on the wall. Tell me, square riggers, what's up?
Well, we got those at the flea market.
Ugh. It reminds me of the Cheryl Wheeler song, Estate Sale. You know?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful frame and the picture's all right.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. We're in, we live in Portland, Maine.
Uh-huh.
And then this is our house that we have in Georgetown, which is about an hour north. Uh-huh. So we bought this house, but in order to afford it, we rented out on Airbnb. So there's a lot of, it's like decorated really nicely.
Yeah.
So we found these cool paintings, but they're like, I don't know. My wife is like very good at placing photos. But
yeah.
She just kind of like threw them up there on the wall. So there's like no real artistic placement, but
nice.
I'm glad you like them.
It's fun. Thank you for your time and thanks for getting the word out. I really appreciate it. It's fun talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. And I love the new record and really enjoyed this conversation. Can't wait to listen back.
All right.
All right.
See ya.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on basicfolk.com, folkalley.com, or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, or you can listen to us wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, perhaps you should share it with a friend. Like maybe that friend who just loves getting on their bicycle and riding around town, going on bike tours, going on biking, camping trips, and just living that biker lifestyle. Send it to that friend. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.